This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com investigative reporter Hillary Lake, River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and James Pilcher, investigative reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Michael, Hillary, and James, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, James, it's official now. Cincinnati has a mayor's race occurring. Yvette Simpson announced this week that she's going to be challenging Mayor John Cranley. And this seems to me like a really interesting matchup.
Yeah. I got my first taste of exactly how much pull Yvette Simpson may have when I was covering the Parks Levy last fall. And she walked into the anti-Parks Levy rally, and people started just chanting, "Yvette for mayor, Yvette for mayor, Yvette for mayor." So, I mean, that groundswell has been building for a while. And it certainly does. I mean, there's been a split on council between those who are more in the Cranley camp and those who are more in tune to what Yvette Simpson's views are. And I think you're going to see that in the city as well. And the other thing that's interesting, too, is on the outside, there's much scuttlebutt now that Greg Hartman might enter, who's kind of sitting on the sidelines, might enter as a Republican.
On the Republican side.
On the Republican side. So yeah, I mean, we're obviously Mayor Cranley and Yvette would face off in the primary, but it certainly would make an interesting general. Whoever wins that would go on to the general.
Now, both Simpson and Cranley, they're Democrats, but they've both had a number of differences on a lot of different issues. You were talking about the Parks Levy. She was against it, and Cranley was in favor of it.
Well, it was Cranley's idea.
Yeah.
Cranley actually put so much political capital into it, and then we did some reporting and showed some things that maybe weren't right kosher with the way the parks was being run, and they just did it. He actually ordered an audit, like – Mayor Cranley actually ordered an audit of the Parks Department as he is trying to pass the Parks Levy at the same time, a couple of weeks before the vote, and then it fell by a 3-2 margin. So, yeah, he put a lot of his own political capital into it, and now Ms. Simpson could actually tie that back. Some of the things that maybe we've found or whatever that can can tie that back. Not only that. He tried to get this Parks Levy passed on the Parks Department is, not operating the way it should. But he actually tried to get Willie Carden to be his own city manager. And now Willie Carden is being questioned about the way he's running the Parks Department.
And it's not just the parks. I mean, there are a number of different issues. On the streetcar, mm-hmm. Simpson was a supporter and Cranley opposed it. They differed on the firing of Police Chief Jeffrey Blackwell. There was an over-the-Rhine parking plan passed council, I think, 5-4, and then Cranley vetoed that plan. Simpson was one of the supporters on that.
And the most recent thing lately is that now Cranley wants to give raises to all the union employees, especially firefighters and police officers. And Ms. Simpson is saying, we don't need to work together on that. You're the mayor. I'm the city council. We're not even, Cranley's trying to create a coalition around this. And Simpson is backing away from even that, not necessarily saying we don't need the raises, but she doesn't want to work with Cranley. So obviously the politics are certainly in play with the policies right now.
You know, there was speculation for months and months and months about whether Yvette was going to run or not. So I'm wondering, do you have any idea why she decided to finally?
Probably I'm speculating here because I don't know that for fact, but I would speculate maybe she needed to make sure she hit a certain milestone in terms of fundraising. It might be that she needed certain people to behind the scenes to promise certain things. There's a lot that goes into stuff like this, especially when you're taking on an incumbent mayor who for all his potential.
It's not going to be an easy
race.
It's
not going to be easy. I mean, Cranley has, while he has been questioned as a policymaker and his demeanor has been questioned, he has been an effective politician in the past. So, it probably took a lot of that. Maybe she needed to get her family finally convinced. There's a lot of things that go into this.
And another thing I understand, too, is if she had run for council this and won, she faced term limits the next time, so she couldn't run for council.
Right.
Again,
so this is her chance to move up, and then if she proves to be a successful mayor, who knows where it goes from there.
Michael, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, you know, this election will happen in a year where there aren't any elections in Kentucky, so we'll all be taking a deep breath on the Kentucky side of the river and watching you guys work your tails off covering this one.
In 2017.
From our perspective, right. though, you know, it's watching Cincinnati politics play out, you see that there was some deep unpopularity for the mayor in certain corners of Cincinnati. Has that expanded out beyond that corner, like the Roxanne Qual supporters from the previous election? Is it just the same people who will be defeated soundly by him again?
That's an interesting question, because I think with the potential of a bona fide Republican candidate waiting in the wings, in the last election, Cranley pulled a lot from more conservative voters within the city limits. He might not get that much financial or, you know, visible support if they know they can throw it behind a guy like Greg Hardman, who's a proven Republican candidate. So, you know, Cincinnati is obviously more Democrat than Republican, but whether or not he's able to pull those same strings, last time they didn't have any Republican opposition of note. So he was able to pull those more conservative voters. I mean, within that circle that you're talking about, that anti-Cranley circle, the pro-streetcar who railed against how he fought against the streetcar, that's that same circle. They basically called him a Democrat in name only, a dino, you know, because he was so entied with the more conservative. I mean, Coast endorsed Cranley, of all things. So, you know, we'll just have to see how that plays out.
There have been some interesting combinations with Coast through the years.
Oh, yeah.
And he ran for Congress twice in the early 2000s. And compared, other than Steve Driehaus, who ultimately won one shot against Steve Chabot, Cranley performed better than most Democrats did in the first district against Steve Chabot. So he does have some appeal, I assume, to some conservative voters.
Absolutely. But back in the day when he was running as a congressional candidate, he was running actually more to the left than he is now. So, you know, how that all plays out.
Sure.
I remember he was actually highlighted in an MTV. MTV did a politics, and a young and up-and-coming guy trying to take on the establishment, and they featured this guy, John Cranley, who was a single, you know, white guy from Cincinnati trying to take on this long-term Republican congressman. And seeing what he was like then and seeing what he's like now, it's been quite an evolution.
Hillary, as the newcomer to town, you want to weigh in on any of this?
Well, you know, I think the thing that strikes me is that it's such a it's so far out for Yvette to be announcing. You know, I mean, as contentious as it's going to be, there's a lot of time. And, you know, I think it takes some of the attention off of, for Cranley anyway, actually doing the job of mayor, because now you've got to worry about a campaign. So,
well, I mean, Cranley's longtime chief of staff actually left that position to work on the campaign full time as well. So they're already starting to gear up. And if anything, I think, you know, you're asking why it took so long, to her point that it's actually a long way out from even the primary. We're all about a year out from the primary, or a little bit less than a year out. But it also quells all those rumors. I mean, if finally Yvette can just say, yes, I'm running. And the only, from a citizen, I don't live in Cincinnati, but from a Cincinnati citizen's perspective, I would imagine this might create some deadlock at city council.
Yeah. Those meetings are going to be interesting.
Yeah, the meetings are going to be definitely interesting, because you're going to have the pro-Yvette block, like with the Chris Seelbach.
A little on the tense side.
Exactly, with Chris Seelbach and some others. And then you've got the Cranley side trying to get things done, maybe not, or whatever. There's certainly going to be. You've already started to see it, like I said, with the union contracts and things like that.
Well, I think this, too, would give her more time to concentrate on fundraising for that particular office.
Absolutely.
I think the last figure I heard was he had well over $200,000, and she had somewhere in the neighborhood of 80. I don't remember the exact figures, but it's somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Michael, you were talking about how next year is going to be the year where Kentucky sits back, watches Ohio run around like crazy, and things are so busy. But this year is shaping up to be a pretty busy year in Kentucky, especially in the municipal elections locally. And the deadline, I think, was Tuesday for Kenton County. And you had a lot of activity for municipal races, people filing for those.
Yeah, we finally know exactly what the November ballot's going to look like across Northern
Kentucky. It's going to be pretty busy.
It's going to be very busy. So in Kentucky, there are different levels of cities. So some city candidates have to file back in January in case they have to compete in the May primary. And other cities don't have to have primaries, so they file in August. So what we saw on Tuesday was that there are nearly a dozen candidates running for the city councils in Ludlow, in Bellevue, in Independence, in Dayton. And Covington has a hot mayor's race and a commission race coming up. And Newport's got a mayor's race and a pretty competitive commission seat, commission race also. I mean, you're going to see a lot of movement. And I think this is going to be an epic battle in Northern Kentucky. I really do. And I think that those of you in Cincinnati who might not pay a lot of attention to the urban cities in Kentucky, I think you should this year. Because what we're seeing are initiatives take place across the region that link us more as one giant playground, as one giant urban center, where Red Bike, for example, can be ridden across the bridge from Cincinnati to Covington, from Newport. We're all very much connected. But you're going to see policymakers chosen in some of these cities that are going to be making decisions about whether programs like that should be expanded, whether the streetcar should be explored to come
over
to Northern
Kentucky. The Brent Spence Bridge.
You can't say that word
to me. It's a never-ending issue.
It is a never-ending issue. It absolutely is a never-ending issue. And there are going to be – that's going to play – the Brent Spence Bridge is going to be a major factor in the Covington mayor's race. You have the incumbent mayor who was one of the few Northern Kentucky politicians to come out in favor of – tolling that bridge as a mechanism for financing it. And her opponent is the former state senator and Frankfurt bureaucrat who led a coalition to oppose the bridge. So that's going to be a major factor in the race. So watch the River City News for these these River City elections, because they're going to be epic.
Keep an eye on Northern Kentucky politics.
Absolutely.
This year. What's the Newport mayor's race? Who's that between?
So Jerry Peluso. It's good to have an Italian name in Newport. Get you pretty far. And the Peluso name is a well-established brand in Newport. His cousin Frank Peluso is also on the city commission. So two-fifths of the Newport commission is the Peluso family. And Peluso has drawn a challenger and a man named Chris Maloney, who I don't know a whole lot about yet. But we'll get to know them as the campaign unfolds a little bit. They have a seat on the commission that's going to be available. Newport has a long history of recently anyway of reelecting their incumbent commissioners. And this commission has been intact for a while. But one, John Hayden is running for district judge this year. So at least one seat's up for grabs. And you got a couple of strong candidates. Ken Recton, who was a longtime Campbell County commissioner, is seeking his old seat on the Newport Commission. So he's got to be a heavy favorite to take one of those seats. And it's possible one of the incumbents could be picked off if a strong enough campaign is waged. So Newport's up for grabs too this year.
Which race are you keeping the closest eye on?
I did a podcast by myself. It was very lonely and sad, but I did a podcast by myself earlier this week where I talked about what I think is the hottest race in Northern Kentucky this year. And this is going to surprise some people, I think, but I think it's in Taylor Mill. And
really?
For those of you who don't know where Taylor Mill is, it's just south of Covington. And it's where I went to high school, Scott High School, Go Eagles. So a little shout out to that old neck of the woods. But Taylor Mill had a state road project that widened the street and added a new highway. And Taylor Mill is a suburban community, but they're looking to establish this sort of urban downtown environment. And they have one development that's up already. It's really lovely. The buildings are really cool, and they're trying to build more buildings closer to the street. They want to look more like a downtown. And they've got they call it the trifecta, because they've got the three major Cincinnati brands there. Grader's, La Rosa's, and Skyline are part of this trifecta development. However, there's a parcel across from it where a man has been trying to bring the other iconic Cincinnati brand, UDF, to town. And if you go to Taylor Mill City Commission meetings like the River City News does, you hear about this UDF all the time. They have not had a vote on it for 2 years. They won't let this guy because it goes against their plan for what downtown is supposed to look like. Well, he's decided he's going to run for city commission instead. And so you can expect that this is going to be the UDF election in Taylor Mill, and it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
We will continue our review of local news after this, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com investigative reporter Hillary Lake, River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and James Pilcher, investigative reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. You had a great question that you wanted to ask
I was asking Michael off the air. You know, I've obviously covered a lot about the Brent Spence Bridge, and I know how much it plays into Covington politics. Who's going to win the mayor's race? I mean, who would if you were to do a poll right now, who would be winning and who do you think is going
to
win?
I think you'd find a pretty close race, but I think the edge has to be given to Joe Meyer, who is the challenger against incumbent Sherry Caron.
Who is anti-toll, by the way.
So Joe Meyer is anti-toll and Sherry Caron is in favor of building the bridge, even if that means using tolls. And the real poll that we had was the May primary. There were a couple of other candidates who ran small campaigns, which forced a primary. So we got to see the state of the race back in May, and the state of the race was Joe Meyer got 47% and Sherry Caron got 40%. The other two candidates bagged the other 13%. So we see that Joe Meyer was strongest in Latonia, which is the center of the city, and the south end of the city, which is where about 25% of the population lives. But Sherry was much stronger in the downtown neighborhoods. And what's happening in Covington, of course, is Covington is really undergoing a major renaissance. There's a lot of development happening downtown. But the folks out in Latonia are saying, well, what about us? And the people in the south end are saying, well, what about our firehouse, where you've reduced the number of EMTs who are working out here now because of the budget constraints. So I would say the state of the race currently favors Joe, but we're going to see over the course of the campaign, through the forums, the debates, and through the coverage by people like us, whether that stands. But it's going to be a close race, I think.
Well, I think, and just in terms of Kenton County politics in general, people tend to forget how powerful the southern end of both Covington and of the county can be. Everybody thinks about Kenton County politics in terms of inside the loop, inside of Covington, inside the city. But most of the political power, a lot of the political power lies to the south. I know that definitely came into play when Chris Knockelman took over as judge executive. He won the south because they felt like they had been ignored for so long. In terms of their sewers, in terms of the other things. And Chris came in and said, well, we're going to take care of you. He's from that area and so forth.
That's right. You know, and a lot of people in the South End, they get visited by politicians once. And that's when it's time to walk the streets. And I'm from South Covington. And so I know the area pretty well. Sherry Caron lost South Covington last time, too. She won the North End and she faced a fellow city commissioner at that time, Steve Casper, who carried South Covington. But she was able to win the election in spite of that. I think her challenge is going to be to keep it close in Latonia and South Covington and run up the scoreboard downtown.
513-419-7100. John in Coleraine Township joins us. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
Hey, I was wondering on the Brent Spence where it stands as far as I know Driehaus did a $24 million survey while he was in there, and I wondered if you guys thought that we kind of lost our place in line with McConnell maybe losing the Senate and John Boehner stepping down, and maybe we should have got something done while we had some kind of support in there. And I will take my I'll listen to you off the air.
Thanks. Hey, thanks, John.
Hi, this is James. I can't honestly say that we've lost anything by losing John Boehner or losing Mitch McConnell. Neither one of them seemed to really want to move the bridge. Neither one of them wanted to increase government spending very much. The highway bill always became a major contentious issue between the administration and Congress. So I don't necessarily think we've lost a place in line because of that. I think we've lost our place in line because of the constant policy, political debates over how to pay for it. And the transportation department doesn't want to sit around and wait. They're going to go to other places with plans in place. We don't have a plan in place. Now the new governor comes in, Bevin comes in and says, I want another study. So I want to look at this bypass. I'm going to spend $10 million?
Yeah.
I think it was another $10 million on looking at alternatives, even though those alternatives have already been vetted four times. So we're looking at it again. That's why we're losing our place in line, not necessarily because of, what's going on in Congress. If the project shows that it is deserving and it can show that it has a viable financial plan, it's going to get pushed through Congress. When we lost Jim Bunning, out of the Senate. We lost the major champion and George Voinovich. We lost the two major champions, moderate Republicans who were willing to spend money on transportation. When we lost those two guys out of the Senate, we lost our champions. And that's been the case for the last 10 years.
I see. I take the cynical view, James. I look at how long this has been going on, how long this has been an issue. It's been decades.
I wrote my story in 2003 on how dangerous it was. I showed that the Brent Spence Bridge was the seventh most dangerous bridge in terms of accidents of its kind in the country in 2003. And that pushed the needle a lot. But since then, it's been a debate because obviously federal funding has dried up. There is a legitimate argument that the feds should pay for it. It's theirs. But realistically, the feds aren't paying for any of it anymore. So, you know, that's a discussion level much higher than our pay grade, if you will.
And what are we asking for in Kentucky anymore? You know, when you talk about the Brent Spence Bridge in Kentucky.
You ask for so little, Michael.
I really do. Just $1 billion bridge or $2.5 billion bridge. But there are people who argue that we don't need the bridge, or there are people that we do need the bridge, but we don't need to toll it, or we do want the bridge and we can toll it and it's okay, or don't build a bridge. What we need is a bypass through the rural parts of the. There are so many different arguments that emerged just within the last 15, 18 months that the narrative around this project has changed so dramatically. And Northern Kentucky in particular is so unfocused that we probably did miss an opportunity with Governors Beshear and Kasich, who came together and said, let's do this thing.
Yeah. And I might be editorializing here a little bit, but I would say that some of that obfuscation, if you will, was intentional. That some of this is going on because purely they don't want tolls, so they're throwing these other alternatives out there. I'm not saying tolls are the answer, but the reason we have all of these other alternatives.
You're saying they're doing this just to slow down the debate.
Absolutely.
Let's move on to another topic because this one will never end.
It won't end.
Hillary, Sunday morning there was a police-involved shooting. This was on Government Square, and you've done a lot of extensive coverage on this. Tell us what happened.
Well, I'm going to take us back to Sunday. You know, this man, who we now know as Jawari Porter, he was 25 years old, was in the Kroger on Vine Street in OTR. There's surveillance video that he held a knife up to a security guard who was in the store, and a store employee called police. A few blocks later, a few minutes later, two police officers spotted him, tried to take him in. They tried to stop him, basically. Porter, there's also surveillance video of Porter going in the driver's side door of the police car and trying to attack the officer who was in there. And that officer ultimately shot Porter. Monday, Police Chief Isaac, Mayor, they come out and they say, you know, we want to release the surveillance video of this to the public. We've made a commitment to do that, but we can't because Hamilton County Prosecutor has issued a subpoena to keep that video private until he determines whether or not this shooting was justified. And then several hours later, Joe Dieters announced that, yes, he determined that the shooting was justified.
Mm-hmm. So the officer was defending himself.
The officer was defending himself.
Pulled a knife and he felt he had no other choice.
Right, right.
If I could be a little self-serving like Michael.
Take it back.
Go right ahead.
No, the Inquirer, the fact that that Joe Dieters is withholding these videos has come up before. We are actually—
That goes back to the Tensing case,
doesn't it? It does.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we are actually, the Inquirer is actually arguing in front of the Ohio Supreme Court. And actually, Dieters has encouraged this because he wants a final ruling. The open records laws are not clear on these videos. So we are actually arguing this in front of the Ohio Supreme Court as to when and how— those videos need to be released to the media. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Yeah, no problem at all.
Now, in your reporting, what did you find out about Jawari Porter? You did a lot of digging into his life.
Right.
Didn't you?
So, you know, like we do with any story, you start digging into the backgrounds of the people involved. And with Jawari Porter, you know, I think initially it got simplified that this was just another black man who was trying to kill a police officer.
Right. Another cut and dry case. He had a knife. The officer shot him. And that's the end of the story.
Right. But in the end, I think with this story specifically, we have to consider Jawari Porter's background because he was in the system. And by the system, I mean he was in foster care from the time he was a baby until he graduated from high school. And then there's a transitional period where he got a scholarship, went to UC, actually graduated from UC, had a very, very promising future, and then something happened. And in 2011, he was arrested for exposing himself in a Kroger. Don't know which Kroger, but exposing himself in a Kroger. That went through the criminal justice system. It was determined he was mentally incompetent to stand trial or to face these charges. So he was kicked over to probate, and which is civil, goes through the probate system, goes through 60 days of treatment, I believe, gets out and sort of drops off the face of the earth, so to speak. And we don't really have any contact with him again. Nobody has contact with him again in terms of records that we could find until 2015. He was arrested for attacking a woman, just literally sucker punching her in the face in the casino. There's surveillance video of that that Joe Dieters released last week or earlier this week as well. And same this exact same thing happened. He gets charged criminally. They determine that he's mentally incompetent, goes into to probate court. That case was actually, the civil case was just closed in June. And then we have this happen.
So what kind of reaction has there been from the community about the shooting?
Well, I think, you know, it really depends on who you talk to. A lot of people, especially social media, writing to me saying, you know, why are we even considering the background of this guy?
Oh, you took some flack
for
writing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You know, I had a few tweets, but I also had some tweets from the other way. You know, yeah, this is something that we need to be talking about, the mental health issue. The young, you know, he's a young black man with mental health issues. Does that excuse the violence? No, but I think it gives some perspective into his mental state and what was going through his mind and why he did what he did.
And well, certainly, and we've also heard from community leaders, Black Lives Matter, some of those folks saying, and actually advocates for the mentally ill. And I'm not saying I agree with them here, but their argument was that maybe the police exacerbated it by pulling their guns initially, mm-hmm. and that they could have calmed him down a little bit or tased him or whatever instead of immediately pulling their guns, putting him on the offensive, and then he attacks and gets shot. So I'm not agreeing with them. I'm just saying that it certainly is a narrative out there.
Well, and sorry to interrupt.
No, okay.
A little bit more about Porter's background, and the police would have had no idea of knowing this piece of it. That I tracked down one of his former JFS caseworkers after the initial coverage ran, and he's no longer living here in the Cincinnati area, but he had contact with Porter from 2005 to 2010. That would have been when Porter was teenage years around. And he said that Porter was a good kid. He was trying to be a good human being, but that he did have some anger issues, and that Porter constantly was standing up for people who he felt was wronged. And so in this instance, if he felt that he was wronged in some way, this is going to be his reaction.
Now, you were saying that the police at this point, they don't have their body cams. They don't have these yet in Cincinnati.
Right.
They just started rolling those out this week. This is all caught by surveillance video when
right.
it happened.
Right.
Okay. But now we do have body cams being rolled out by the Cincinnati Police Department. I think they just started this week with the Central Business District, James.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
yes.
right?
That's correct.
How many cameras are they deploying at this point? Do we?
I want to say it's a few dozen.
I was going to say it's less than 50.
Yeah.
It's less than 50.
I by think. The end of the year, I think there's supposed to be 700
yeah.
out there.
Yeah.
So this is just a small device that they're going to wear. It's about, what, the size of a cell phone?
Yeah. It goes on.
It
goes on
the middle of the vest.
Right. It goes right in the middle of their chest and the middle of their vest. The camera, if anybody's seen the video of the University of Cincinnati officer Ray Tenzing and Sam DuBose, that was shot with a body cam. But that was UC police, not Cincinnati police. But it's the same kind of camera. You carry it on you. It's battery powered, and it stores up to 4 or 5 hours worth of video, and then you have to refresh it. You can also upload it to a server.
These don't come on automatically.
Yeah, the issue is they're powered on, but they're not recording for the entire shift.
Right.
The officer, when something happens, actually has to hit a button that starts recording. And I can tell you that a couple weeks ago, there was a police shooting in San Diego. The San Diego Police Department has received a lot of flack and actually questions from lawmakers now because the officers there, they didn't press the button to start recording until way after, and one of the officers died. And the police chief came out the day that the shooting happened and said, we have body cam footage of this. Well, they didn't have body cam footage of the actual shooting because the officers didn't push the buttons on their cameras until it was kind of like they forgot.
Well, it creates a whole policy issue about whether you take that control out of the officer's hands or not, whether or not this goes back to a central dispatch office. How much of the footage do you keep? Because you're talking about computer storage.
And for how long?
And for how long? You're talking about privacy concerns because if they've got it up going into a domestic debate, a domestic dispute and somebody wants to open records that, and I get to see my neighbors arguing, is that open to the public or not? So all of this has actually been discussed in the Ohio legislature. And it got to the point where the at least from the perspective of some of the lawmakers, that the police unions were asking for like review. They wanted to be able to review or have the officers be able to review the footage before it was released to the public so they could get, you know, they could see it and review it. And the lawmakers finally balked at that. So there's still no clear statewide policy on how this footage or how these spotted cams should or shouldn't be implemented. Cincinnati,
but I'm sure Cincinnati's got some kind of guidelines for the officers.
They
to
do,
follow.
But it still has to be officially approved by city council. So that's still up in the air. So all of this, as they put in the technology, how we deal with it or how we handle it is still up in the air.
And the FOP came out this week too and said that
they're not entirely happy.
They're not happy with this at all, and they're considering, I believe they're considering legal action, mm-hmm. because they're contending that this creates a whole nother duty that these officers have to do, not just from pushing the button, but from downloading the video, from making sure that it gets to the right people who will then archive the video. This adds an additional duty to their day that is not in their current contract.
Right. They see this as a contractual issue. It's not so much the cameras themselves, but how they were implemented.
And they're right in the middle of contract negotiations right now.
Yeah.
Michael, what about in Northern Kentucky? I mean, how many departments down there are
a lot of – first of all, we have a lot of police departments in Northern Kentucky in the three counties that we traditionally refer to as Northern Kentucky. Nearly every city has its own police department. The counties have their own county police and sheriff's department, so there's a lot of them to keep track of. But a lot of the departments have adopted body cams. And just this week, I believe my friends at Fort Thomas Matters just reported that the Fort Thomas police are the latest to add body cameras. And I haven't seen any pushback from the officers or the police unions there. What you're seeing in the city meetings where they're discussing the cost is the concern about storing the video and how much it actually costs, because you have to think that this is video that people like us are going to come asking for at some point. How long down the road does this stuff need to be saved? And so there's a whole lot of presentations going on in all of the municipal and county government buildings about how are we going to store all this data.
Well, and I think with the issue with pushing the button to actually start the camera recording too, I mean, if you have, I don't know, hundreds of officers every day and they've got those cameras rolling for their, you know, 10 to 12 hour shifts and nothing has happened on the shift that really needed to be recorded, but then you still have to store all that data.
Well, I imagine they tell them there are certain instances in which you turn the camera on, but certain types of contacts and things that you're doing where you should turn the camera
on. No, but I'm saying if they didn't implement a procedure like that, if they just said you have to have your camera running your entire shift, then it comes down to, you know, who's going to make the decision on what part of the video needs to be saved versus what doesn't need to be saved. So there's pros and cons
and
to doing this either way.
And there's the police officer's right to privacy too. I mean, he eats lunch, he goes to the bathroom, stuff like that. So, I mean, is that all going to be recorded? Those are still things up in the air.
Okay. We will continue our conversation. You can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to talk about the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com investigative reporter Hillary Lake, River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and James Pilcher, investigative reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer and Kentucky Inquirer. And you can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We got a comment from Bernadine from Clifton, and she says she does not care how the new bridge, since we're talking about the Brent Spence Bridge, and it's your fault, James.
I agree.
Since we're talking about the bridge, she says she doesn't care how it gets done, just as long as it gets done. And that seems to me like probably the sentiment of a lot of people around.
But where was she from?
Clifton.
Thank you.
See?
I live in I'm with Michael on this, that Northern Kentucky has a bit of a different perspective because we use the bridge more to go into Ohio than Ohioans use it to go into Kentucky, and we're going to pay more tolls. I'm not saying I'm opposed to tolls. Please don't anybody say I'm anti-toll because I said that, but that's just the reality of it, and that's where a lot of the sentiment comes from for the anti-tolling.
Let's talk about there was quite a mess in Pendleton County this week. A big train derailment. I think the train itself was 125 cars. And it had 24 of the cars actually come off the track. huge impact. I mean, this actually happened in Falmouth, didn't it, James?
Yes, it did, and it actually some of the cars were carrying sulfuric acid. So CSX and the local law enforcement and the emergency management crew actually evacuated most of the city for fear that those cars were leaking, which would have created a toxic gas cloud. As it turns out, none of the cars were actually leaked, and within 4 or 5 hours, the people were allowed to go back into their homes and stuff. But yeah, that one actually brought back memories of the styrene leak on the east side, when a car that had been parked on the on a siding over on the
that
east
happened
end.
In 2005.
Was 05, it 05? Yeah, it was 05.
Yes, we just changed over here. It was one of the first stories I remember the station covering when we moved into this new facility.
I mean, several thousand people had to be evacuated because this car had been sitting there for several months unattended, and they lost track of it. Basically, it was full of styrene, which is a gas substance they use to make plastics, and it started venting, and it not lethal, but could burn you, and you know, bad things can happen. So they had to evacuate a lot of that. So that was the last real bad one we've had in the Cincinnati area. But we have
up to
one
at this point, yeah.
right. And actually, people, I'm sure a lot of people know this, but maybe many people don't. When you drive through I-75, you're driving south, you look over there by Museum Center. That's actually one of the largest train yards in the Midwest. It's Queensgate Train Yard. It's owned by CSX, as a railroad company. I mean, hundreds of trains go through there every day, and many of them do carry hazardous materials.
Hillary, I think in this case, it was fortunate. Nothing hazardous leaked. Nobody was injured either.
They're lucky nobody died. I mean, that was a mess. It looked like a trash compactor just went in there and just mangled the cars all up together.
Now, how far along in the cleanup are they?
They say they're going to be done pretty soon.
This weekend. Yeah. And the tracks are going to be able to be used by Monday. They said that they had 24 of the cars that actually derailed, and by today they had put
about
at least 20
or so.
Oh, we're back on the tracks. So
they've been working 24 hours since it happened to get everything cleaned up, moved out, and the tracks repaired.
And here's how image conscious CSX is. This was a CSX train. They've actually offered, you know, reimbursement for people who had to leave their homes, leave their jobs, or, you know, so they'll pay them. They're going to pay them for their lost wages, their hotel, whatever they had to do if they had to leave. If you can document,
if they had to shut down their business or something like
that,
as a result,
they're gonna reimburse all of that. So this is actually a pretty black eye, big black eye, image wise and financially for CSX.
Do we have any idea yet what caused this derailment?
No, and I actually spent a lot of time earlier this week talking with the Federal Railroad Administration, and the federal group that's coming in, or that has come in to investigate this. And what they told me is that it could take 9 months to a year before they determine a cause, because they have to look at everything from the condition of the tracks that day, the condition of all the cars and the engines, environmental factors, and then there's a whole slew, probably thousands of pages of documents that they have to go through of past car and track inspections that CSX has done, and then the FRA comes in and audits those. So there's a lot of work.
That's the thing about the railroad industry in this country, is that we do have, as part of the Transportation Department, we do have an administration that oversees it. But for the most part, it is a self-policing industry. So the Federal Railroad Administration basically checks everybody's paperwork, for lack of a better word. They're not nearly as detailed or whatever as, say, the Federal Aviation Administration, where you actually have active inspectors going out every day to airports and checking in on mechanics and stuff. They do a lot of auditing, but nothing like what the FRA is. Basically, like Hillary was saying, basically just audits what the railroads already do.
And this stretch of track, and I'm not saying that the tracks were faulty in any way, but this is just an example of what the railroads are required to do in terms of self-policing. This particular stretch of track is required to be inspected 3 times a week, and then there's a report written after each one of those inspections. But that just goes to the CSX offices, and then the FRA will come in. I don't even think they have a time frame that they go in. They just every so often go in and audit the different companies.
But you're saying up to 9 months before they might even figure out what caused this particular derailment.
Well, they've also got to interview the engineer and the driver.
Witnesses.
And the witnesses. Yeah. I mean, are they going to find a user error? Are they going to find a bad switch?
Some of the things that they'll look at, though, is human error, like I said, you know, the environmental factors, the condition just of all the equipment.
Right.
And at this point, you know, there's really no indication of what direction this is going to fall.
Michael, have you heard any thoughts from local leaders about how the response was handled to this?
You know, I think that local governments in particular have had a long, complicated history with the railroads, and for a very long time. One of our most famous figures in Covington history is a guy named William Goble, who is well known across Kentucky for being the assassinated governor and the only governor in the history of the country to die from an assassin's bullet. And he was a Covington guy. And he railed against the railroads for a long time, so much so that when he died and it was time to bring his body back from Frankfort, where he was shot, to Covington, where he would lay in state, the railroad wouldn't bring him directly up. He had to be on a different train that took him through Indiana and around to Cincinnati and back across to Covington. So local governments have had a long, complicated history with the railroads. I mean, they bring a lot of industry, of course, but if you look at the condition of some of the overpasses, of some of the sidewalks that have been closed in Covington for a very long time, little simple things like community groups wanting to put murals on some of their properties, you can't get a hold of them. I have a hard time talking to the railroad on some of those matters. It's not a great relationship, and considering the amount of land that they're using, that you'd think they could probably be better neighbors.
Not just to that issue, but also to the all of these communities that have these tracks, especially mainline tracks. Norfolk Southern, for example, runs the line that goes all the way through the Cumberland Gap down to Chattanooga. But the city of Cincinnati actually owns that track as an aside, and they rent it to Norfolk Southern. But all of those communities that go through have to be ready, because there is so much poison and so much hazardous material that these trains carry, because they don't want it on the roads next to cars, so they put it on trains. But these trains do go through towns, and all of these towns have to have the special foam that's necessary. They can't just fight it with water if one of these trains falls over and blows up.
And foam is very expensive.
Exactly. So, and not only that, but I've talked to many, many community leaders on both sides of the river who are frustrated because the feds or the railroads won't tell them how much of the stuff is coming through. They don't have to. There's no regulation requiring any of the railroads to disclose what exactly they're carrying at any given time. So nobody knows how much sulfuric acid or, more increasingly, crude oil pulled out of the shale fields of eastern Ohio, which is incredibly volatile. None of these communities know. They might have some idea. And here in Cincinnati, we're fortunate. We do have an emergency management planning team that does coordinate with CSX, but they won't tell the public what's on those trains. So, you know, that's all out there. And I know Hillary's done some stories on this, and she was talking about how she did it out in Portland. There have been towns, entire towns, have blown up in Canada carrying these, carrying the crude oil.
The oil, yeah.
Carrying the oil. It just blew up an entire town, like 20 or 30 buildings just were destroyed. So that's getting to Michael's point. That's another big frustration by the local leaders is many times they don't know what's coming through. They don't know how to prepare for it.
How do you think the local emergency responders did in this case? How did the Falmouth and the county folks do?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I talked to the Kentucky Emergency Management Office, and they said, oh, no, the local officials are handling the response to this. And initially I thought about, you know, what would happen if something like this happened in the Portland area where I just moved here from. And Portland Fire, if this happened in a rural area, would actually go, or the fire department at the airport would actually mobilize, because that's who has the most amount of this foam stuff if it was needed. So that was my first. I even called Cincinnati Fire and I said, hey, are you guys sending anybody down there? Because early on, we didn't know exactly, you know, what was in these cars and how much of a danger there was to the public and what was going to be needed to fight any sort of disaster beyond what was visible. So, you know, with the local leaders, I think they did as well as they could have. I think everybody got very lucky. Had there been a fire, had there been different types of chemicals in there, had this been crude oil, we would have been talking a completely different situation, and it would have literally been all hands on deck from all over the region, because the railroad companies they're required to supply a certain amount of this foam stuff along these routes, but it's I've had the railroads out in Portland tell me it's not enough. We know it's not enough if there was a giant fire.
A larger
fire.
Disaster,
yeah. So that's where then the local folks come in.
And as much as we were just railing on the FRA, there was one thing that I think played into this, and that the FRA, to their credit, the Federal Railroad Administration, to their credit, a few years ago, did require most of the railroads to replace their tank cars. So the, you know, whether or not that played a factor in nothing leaking in this case, well, I don't know, because I don't know, you know, if those cars were newer or not. But the FRA has recognized this and is requiring a more stable, more safe tank car for crude oil and other chemicals as we go forward.
Michael, Covington's had a change in leadership. They had the economic development director. I wanted to ask you about this, Jeff Mills. I've talked to Jeff before. He's been on the job for 16 months, and he's going back to Coleraine Township.
Going back to Coleraine Township, and caught us all by surprise.
I saw that in the River City News, and I thought, what's happening here?
Well, the official word is that he wanted to go back to a place that's been close to his heart since he was a child, is what he said. I believe I read in the community press that covers Coleraine Township that he's going to be paid $95,000, which is a higher salary than what he was making in Covington. But man, he was a whiz kid in Covington.
He was doing a phenomenal job.
Well, he was, and they were relying on him heavily because he was just very talented and was leading a lot of initiatives that are, I mean, Covington is hopping right now, and there are a lot of deals in the pipeline, a lot of projects already off the ground that he was sort of handling. And they had just restructured the economic development department at City Hall around him in a lot of ways. And he was going to have a new position created underneath him. And now they're looking for two people. So this really caught people by surprise.
Wasn't he one of the key figures in landing that boutique hotel where the City Hall used to be?
Well, he was the hotel development was prior to his arrival. But in the time since, a lot of the developments that was a catalyst for, certainly helped spearhead for sure. Yeah.
So any ideas who is going to replace him?
Well, this is a brand new change. And I talked to the city manager yesterday when I found out about this. And, you know, they were really caught off guard that Jeff was going to be leaving. So what the city manager said was the only positive about Jeff leaving is that we now know exactly what we want. So I'm sure they're busy putting together the application form now, but no ideas. It's a great job for people who want to work in city government with a lot of stuff happening. Apply to Covington. There's a couple of great positions in the economic development
department. But it seems like he's going to be a hard person to follow.
Well, they keep getting better with each hire. I've covered Covington government for 5 years now, and the last three economic development directors, it's been an improvement. Each time they've had people to build upon the success of the previous one. So hopefully that trend continues for the sake of the city.
And one other thing, let's not forget Covington Chili.
Yeah.
They have a new owner.
The TV news producer for me is helping you put a little bow on our show here today, because we're going to come full circle with a little 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon just quickly, because John Cranley stepped down from city council in 2009, was replaced by a guy named Greg Harris, who has now bought Covington Chili and is revitalizing. It's our chili dive bar, so come on down there and check it out. And now Greg Harris is being talked about on WVXU by Michael Monks with James Pilcher, starred in She's Having a Baby with Kevin Bacon.
Are they going to serve beer? They're really going to serve beer at the chili place?
I think that he's looking to do all kinds of hip stuff, because Covington Chili, as far as the local...
Covington's a hip and up-and-coming
place.
It is
a hip up-and-coming place, but we never had that chili establishment to the pedigree of some of the ones in Cincinnati neighborhoods. And now I think
Camp Washington,
Price Hill. Exactly. Yeah. This place has always kind of been avoided by those of us in the know, and it's been there for 80 years. But it smells like an ashtray, and he says that's all going to change. And they're even going to take credit cards. They had this handwritten note on there for years that said cash only, and that's going to change.
You're going to have to become a chili connoisseur now.
I'm going to have to try. I have.
Okay.
It's an acquired taste. People are probably going to hate me for saying that, but I'll keep trying.
It took me three tries to love it.
There we go. Yeah, thank you.
Hillary and Michael and James, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
WCPO.com investigative reporter Hillary Lake, River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and James Pilcher, investigative reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. Retired Federal Appeals Court Judge Nathaniel Jones recently released his memoir, Answering the Call, an autobiography of the modern struggle to end racial discrimination in America. Judge Jones joins us on the next Cincinnati edition to discuss his life and career. We'll also learn more about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And in focus on technology, a stress test could soon feel like going to the moon. That's Cincinnati edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.